And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. As we tape today, last night, television handed out another round of Emmy Awards, and we'll talk about who won, who didn't, and whether it was any fun to watch. Then we'll move on to the realm of education. We like to learn something as well as the next person, so we'll be saluting some of our favorite pop culture professors and teachers. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I write and edit about movies, pop culture, theater, that sort of thing.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm awfully glad to see all of you. Stephen and I were virtually together last night, live blogging the Emmy Awards ceremony. I did spare the other two of you.
I think this is called this is what's called taking one for the team.
It was pretty valiant of you, I have to admit.
Especially since there was football on TV.
It's true. It's true. Your accomplishment will go down in history. And I think the big story of the night, for me at least, was how incredibly boring it was.
Newsflash.
That's my top line takeaway from the Emmys. Really boring.
Now, you're talking about the telecast itself or the awards selections?
It is both, because what happens is, I looked back at my notes from last year, and what I noted at that time was, it was also a boring telecast. Last year was hosted by Jane Lynch, who did her best, but you know, was not an effervescent awards host, despite her good effort. But last year you had some winners, Melissa McCarthy. There were some other folks where it was really fun to see them win. And when you have great winners and people you're really excited to see who maybe you haven't seen before, or it's really cool to see them win, then you have something to sort of buoy the awards. For example, last year when Melissa McCarthy won was the year that the comedy actresses did a bit where they all got up on stage and there was a little tiara that they gave her. And it was a really nice little bit that they did. This year, the comedy actress winner was Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who everybody likes Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And we talked about Veep on the show and that she was very good on Veep. And I think Veep's a good show. I think she's good on it. But boy, Julia Louis-Dreyfus is not a new face at the Emmys.
Yeah. No. It's like, when are they going to award that young upstart Kelsey Grammer or Juliana Margulies?
Exactly. So it's a combination of if the awards themselves are good and fun, it takes away from the fact that the show is often really boring, which it was.
Well, and see, this brings up the larger issue, and I talked about this on the live blog a little bit. The big issue problem with the Emmys is that, unlike something like the Grammys or the Oscars or the Tonys, is generally each piece of art kind of gets one pass in those other, now Grammys will do that thing I hate where a single from an old record will get nominated, but generally,
but that's the exception.
But that's an exception. Each album kind of gets its year in the sun, and whereas with the Emmys, there's a real deja vu grind to, you know, will the Daily Show win for a 10th straight year?
Yeah,
you know, I love the Daily Show, but who cares?
Yeah,
like at this point, Jon Stewart cares even less than I do.
Right, it's true.
Well, let's embrace the novelty. There were two shining examples of that: Damian Lewis for Homeland.
Right.
That was great. That was great to see. He does a good job on that show.
Yes. And Homeland itself, actually.
Right.
Homeland broke a streak by Mad Men, a 4-year streak by Mad Men of winning Outstanding Drama Series. And there were those among my critic pals who thought that maybe Breaking Bad would break that streak, but I actually predicted in the middle of the day yesterday.
You're a genius.
That it would be Homeland. Homeland's on Showtime. Claire Danes, who also won. Damian Lewis. Everybody really seems to respect and like this show. I liked the first season. I felt like it lost a little steam at the very end, but I think that's largely a result of them having to go into a second season when ideally it would have been a 13 and out.
Sure. No, I agree. Yeah. But the big winner for me this year is Melissa McCarthy, was Tom Bergeron.
Yes.
Tom Bergeron.
That's true. We should say Tom Bergeron is the host of Dancing with the Stars.
Right. And you couldn't get me to watch an episode of Dancing with the Stars if you threaten my dog. Okay, if you threaten my dog, I would probably watch Dancing with the Stars. I would also question your priority, but I would watch an episode of Dancing with the Stars. I first found out I really loved this guy way back in 1995. He was the host of a show on FX called Breakfast Time. Lasted only one season, and then it came back later as Fox After Breakfast. Mm-hmm. He has, as a host, something that precious few do, which is this distance from what is happening around him that is not a snarky, ironic distance. It is, if anything, sort of a bemused distance. It's there. It's palpable. You can feel him removing himself, but it's not in that kind of Pat Sajak smarmy, I'm better than these people who can't spell.
He's not above it all. He's parallel to it.
Exactly. It's exactly.
It's a kind of quality that Craig Ferguson has.
Yes, exactly.
It's very similar to that. I think that's absolutely right. And the moment that I fell in love with Tom Bergeron was when, you know, every host has his moment where all of your hosting skills are called upon, especially if you host live. And the day that Marie Osmond passed out during the live broadcast, just absolutely passed out on her feet and clonked to the floor, and nobody knew whether she was still alive. You know, was she having a very, very serious problem? Now, it turned out she had passed out from the exertion and all that and breathing too hard and all that.
But happens to me constantly.
But
we edit that part out of the show.
But he expertly just threw it a commercial, and then they came back and he handled it and it was okay. But that's a really big test for a live host.
Yeah.
And then I read his book, which is called I'm Hosting as Fast as I Can. And you know, most TV people who write a book, you don't need to read it. Unless you really, really, truly love them.
Well, TV game show host. Unless it's Chuck Barris.
Exactly. But Tom Bergeron's book is actually a really compelling story of a guy who sort of had a bunch of jobs. He's done everything from, you know, now he's got an Emmy for this. He's also been the host of America's Funniest Home Videos for a long time, which he refers to as the annuity.
Yes.
I should imagine.
It's the longest IMDb page I have ever seen. This guy's a page.
It is very impressive. And his book, weirdly enough, is also the most interesting book I have read about meditation. He's a huge practitioner of meditation. But not in a hippy-dippy kind of way. It's more in a kind of life management skill kind of way. So I completely agree. Tom Bergeron was a great win.
What do we think of Kimmel? I kind of liked him better when he was just up front telling jokes, and the bits I didn't think worked that well.
Well, you know, I think that Linda, in your recap of the Emmys, I thought put it well, where it's the difference between trying to look cool versus trying to be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. The Emmys will never be cool. No awards show will ever be cool because it's a bunch of rich people giving each other congratulations. That will never be cool. And as I noted in the piece, you know, Jon Stewart stands there and says, oh, this is incredibly dumb and predictable. And then he takes it. And John Cryer gets up and says on the red carpet, well, I don't have a chance because I really don't deserve it. But he gets up and takes it. And at that point, it's not cool. It's never going to be cool. And that's okay. It doesn't have to be. Everything doesn't have to be cool.
Yeah,
but to me, Jimmy Kimmel wanted it to be cool. And that's why he immediately got up and sort of made an Aren't the Emmys Dumb joke, which is what so many hosts think they should do. And you almost never should. If you think about your great hosts like Neil Patrick Harris at the Tonys, Jimmy Fallon when he did the Emmys, they're excited. They're happy. It's fun. Because if it's not going to be fun and you're not going to be enthusiastic, there is literally no reason to be there.
Well, it circles back to what you were saying about Tom Bergeron, that Neil Patrick Harris is a little bit in on the joke when he's hosting the Tonys, but he's also having a blast.
Right.
You know, I can think of exceptions. I really like, as I think I've said on this podcast before, I really like Steve Martin as an awards show host, partly just because I think he has great material. But Steve Martin will do somewhat of that thing where there's distance from it, but not opposition to it.
Right.
And I think that's really the key. And I'm not saying Jimmy Kimmel was bad. I like Jimmy Kimmel. I think Jimmy Kimmel is funny. Jimmy Kimmel has done some funny bits. He's not entirely my cup of tea. I certainly don't watch his talk show. But there's a sense that he's kind of holding salad tongs.
Yeah.
You know, he's holding the show. He's holding the show with salad tongs. And also just in general, I feel personally like, you know, a lot of awards show hosts that sort of de-emphasize the host to the point where it's almost hard to discern who the host of some of these things is.
Yeah, if you miss the opening in particular.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I did feel like the bits he did, my objection to Kimmel, my one real objection to what Kimmel did, is I think the bits he did were too much about himself. I don't think people really want to see you do bits that are really genuinely about yourself. I think the bit where he kicked his parents out of the auditorium, and also the bit where he did the thing with Josh Groban, who did like a sort of in memoriam style tribute to Jimmy Kimmel. I think at some point people don't actually want to see you do jokes about yourself. They want to see you do jokes that embrace famous people from TV.
Well, one thing about the way these awards show hosting gigs work generally is when you bring on a talk show host in particular, you're not only bringing on that host, you're bringing on his or her, usually his, writing staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when Jon Stewart hosts the awards shows, if you look at the writing credits, they're the writers from The Daily Show.
Mm-hmm.
They're his kind of stable of people. And so it sort of stands to reason that when Jimmy Kimmel is going to be an awards show host, that people who are accustomed to writing jokes very specifically to Jimmy Kimmel, they have his sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff really had his sensibility to it. But it's clearly his writers who are working on it, and thus it's kind of about him.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things you said, Linda, in the piece was that this is an opportunity, if nothing else, for you to get exposed to shows you might not have otherwise investigated.
Sometimes.
And you guys were talking last night on the live blog. You were recommending the show Happy Endings to Stephen.
Yes.
I second that. Stephen, I think you're really going to like that show.
I don't want to watch TV.
Well, I'll save you something else. The show American Horror Story, which you also said.
Which I have not seen.
I like the show. I don't think for a second you're going to like
No.
I absolutely do not.
You would not like that
I'm
show
not a big horror guy. We've talked about that before. This show isn't really horror more than it is sort of campiness around horror.
It is.
It's like sitting down to a giant five-course meal of Skittles. No, it's just, it's not satisfying.
No, you are not actually, discouraging me.
I mean, it's got some of this, of horror's attitude toward
tropes
and the kind of normative sort of thing, moralism in it, where
good.
Sex is punished and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also just so much making fun of these tropes in a way that it's entertaining to me. Mm-hmm. Jessica Lange is entertaining
like
to Trey.
Oh, gosh, yes.
See right there?
She is all over it. But I like it because while it's doing all of this, I absolutely agree, there are some genuinely freaky sequences in that show.
I just didn't see that. I was also kind of troubled briefly by the portrayal of this gay couple as this really bitchy, sort of snarky, you know, they kind of hate each other and that they're just bad to each other. But then I thought,
are you talking about Modern Family now?
Why should everybody else on that show be a repellent person and these two people be like normal? So it's like, so equal time.
Yep.
Equal time. But speaking of Modern Family, you have some thoughts on that matter, I believe.
I mean, look, Modern Family is still a fun show. I will still sit down. I was on a plane recently and there was like, you know, the in-flight video and you could pick your own things. And I realized that I had not seen all of this season of Modern Family. And I sat there and watched several of them and I like them. They're fun.
Sure.
But at the same time, it is maybe the sort of most down the middle, despite what everybody says about, like, it's a different kind of family. There's an interracial couple. There's a gay couple. It is the most kind of down the middle in terms of kind of current sensibility of people who make up the television audience. It is a big meatball pitch right over the plate. And to me, I like that. I like the show. But for me, for my purposes, 3 years in a row, sort of shutting out everything else. And they've got so many freaking actors and they all get nominated and it crowds everybody out. And I just...
The supporting actor in a comedy category was ridiculous. I mean, there were 6 nominees and 4 of them were from that show.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which, of course, crowds out other people from every other show. And you could stack most of a category with people from Community. You could stack most of a category with people from Parks and Rec. And so to me, it's not that I don't think it's a good show. It's that I think the complete dominance that it currently has over the comedy Emmys is just excessive. And it also really exposes a flaw. Mostly I think, the way they do the Emmys now, where they do the comedy ones and the drama ones. And because it does mean you don't have to wait until the end for all the ones that you care about.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with it is when they divide it up like that, 2 bad things happen. The first one is you get that gigantic chunk after about the first hour. You get this gigantic chunk of miniseries and variety, which everybody just kind of tunes out and goes to sleep. I was watching the live blog numbers, and people just fled. People just fled. Everybody stopped watching.
Now, truth be told, I was hurling a lot of profanity at that point.
Don't lie. But people really did just tune out. And I don't think it was us. I mean, people did.
It was a little bit us.
People just completely lost interest at that point. And that's a problem. The other problem is, when you're in that comedy section and all those awards are right together, it makes that dominance by one show even more annoying when they're all coming together and you just feel like what is this? Is there only one show on?
Well, especially when they then, after that interminable two-hour load late in the telecast, all of a sudden it was like, and now the big finish. What will win Best Comedy? I have no idea.
Exactly. And the same thing happened sort of with the drama series, in the sense that once Damian Lewis and Claire Danes both had won for their roles on Homeland, I think even the people who hadn't been convinced by my theory earlier in the day, and it was a theory that I was not the only person to think this. It was a minority opinion, but there were other people. I know Dan Feinberg at HitFix said the same thing, that he thought Homeland would win. But by the time Damian Lewis beat Bryan Cranston and Jon Hamm, I think everybody saw the writing on the wall that it was going to be Homeland, at which point you got to wait another hour and a half because we have to wait through all the reality. And
I would be curious to see the ratings curve.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but my sense is people just got really super, super bored in that middle part. And, you know, there was some thought that maybe the miniseries and movie category would be all shaken up by the fact that Sherlock was in there and American Horror Story was in there. But no, it turned out to be mostly a bunch of awards for the HBO Game Change, the politics movie, the successor to Recount, the previous HBO politics movie. And then there were a couple that went to Kevin Costner for that Hatfield and McCoy's thing, which I can't actually
Fresh
be against. I can't be against it because I didn't watch it. But it was certainly not an audience sort of favorite.
Think about the nerd explosion.
That's what I'm talking about.
When Kevin Costner beat out Benedict Cumberbatch and Idris Elba.
That's what I'm talking about. Because in terms of audience, Hatfield and McCoy's was a humongous hit. So you can't say it wasn't popular.
Yeah.
But from my perspective, it was not making people happy. But at any rate, so yeah, Modern Family to me, I don't dislike Modern Family, but yeah, the sort of one-track mind that the Academy had about comedy was pretty baffling to me.
Looking at the repeat winners, your Daily Show and obviously Homeland broke, Mad Men streak, but what should have won in terms of what was up against juggernauts?
That's a good question.
I mean, you're a Parks and Rec.
I am, and they weren't nominated.
Yeah. So they should have won.
I was a little bit disadvantaged in terms of the Modern Family race because a lot of the stuff I would have picked was not nominated. I think, frankly, of the stuff that was there, if you're going to nominate something kind of big and popular and down the middle, I would have gone with Big Bang Theory because they've never won, and I think it's actually a really funny show. I know not everybody feels that way, but I actually think that's a pretty funny show.
Well, and Jim Parsons didn't win for the first time in like 11 straight years.
No, he's won twice.
It feels like 11. I'm going to say it's 11.
Well, before that, it was Alec Baldwin.
You raised a good point to keep in mind about this, which is that this is not the awards that the critics would choose. This is not necessarily the awards that the audience at home would choose. This is what people in the industry think of themselves. So, I mean, that's when there's a disconnect, that's kind of telling.
Yeah. And remember, there's always a lot of like producers and executives and stuff like that who aren't necessarily the people you're thinking of when you're thinking of like the community audience.
Right. Sure.
So it's not necessarily that shocking. I mean, they do have a taste for certain things. They gave a certain amount of recognition to Louis C.K., not a lot, but some. So they're not completely unable to get with more adventurous comedy. Curb Your Enthusiasm was nominated, which many people like. I'm not a big Larry David person, but, you know, Veep, Girls. Uh-huh. Girls was nominated. I liked Girls. There were a lot of good possibilities. In terms of the one that The Daily Show wins, the variety or music or comedy series or whatever it is.
In the category in which it competes against the Kennedy Center Honors.
I was just going to say, it's like the Kennedy Center Honors,
well, that's the
Oscars,
special.
And The Daily Show.
That's the special. But in the series categories, I would have gone, I think, with Jimmy Fallon. Just because, to me, he's done such an interesting thing with that format, which is normally a pretty dull format, but... Those would have been my picks, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have. I think I share with Jon Stewart a desire for Colbert Report to win at some point.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Sure,
yeah. I'd be in favor of that, too. I mean, look, the Emmys are always going to be like this. Every year we have the same conversation, which is the Emmys are boring. They reward the same things year after year. It's not the stuff I like. And every year I tell myself, never go into the Emmys expecting anything else. And then every year I sort of have the same experience. So I'm sure we'll be back here again in a year having the same conversation.
We should just record that one now.
I was going to say, we just did.
Yeah.
Just place it in.
I every year experience the Emmys primarily through the lens of the red carpet. So as I do every year, I think, or after every major award ceremony, I would just like to direct all of the audience to TomandLorenzo.com,
yes,
where you will find much amusing commentary,
yes,
on dresses and hair and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Far better suited to do so than I am, though I did find myself occasionally distracted by outfits more than
it's
I usually am.
It's true. You liked Kerry Washington's dress?
Kerry Washington. Well, I like shiny things.
You
I like loud noises and shiny things.
I know you
can always get me with that.
I know you do, you little goldfish.
That was a dress, in fact.
Yeah, that was
that was a dress.
That was a nice dress.
Well, I think we all watched the Emmys. We don't know if you watched the Emmys, but if you did, or if you have opinions about what should have won, which, let's face it, you probably do, Sherlock people, come and find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Share your opinions. We demand to know. So that's the Emmys. And from the Emmys, I think it's safe to say, get ready for the segue. I learned nothing.
No.
Yes.
But speaking of learning.
This is like jazz.
It really kind of was.
I am the queen of this terrible, terrible segue. The other thing we were going to talk about today was pop culture professors and teachers. And we did talk sometime close to this time last year about schools.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about some of our schools that we have enjoyed in various movies and shows and books. But today we thought we would go to the realm of professors and teachers. Glenn Weldon, would you like to kick us off?
Sure. I'm going to kick us off by paraphrasing the 1986 film Top Gun, as is my wont.
Sure.
When I say I feel the need for tweed. And I'm talking, let's start off right here with Rupert Giles from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I took mine, yes. Go ahead.
Well, no, he's not really.
I knew that would be all of yours.
Not necessarily a teacher, more librarian, but certainly a mentor. He's got the bow tie, he's got the argyle, he's got the tweed,
mm-hmm,
he's got the elbow patches, because you know what they say, patches on the elbow, something. I should have prepared something for that, but I don't have anything.
Yeah.
Point is, awesome. And while we're on the tweed tip, let's go with the professor of archaeology at Marshall College, Dr. Henry Walton Jones Jr.,
yes,
known to his friends and to Nazis as Indiana Jones.
Yes.
I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, or as we're supposed to call it now, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Are we supposed to do that?
Yeah, because
I'm not doing that.
Good.
Retroactively, I think.
Yeah. Exactly. Recently on IMAX, and man, that scene where he is teaching, he looks great. I mean, I wouldn't, if I were one of his students.
Is that new information to you?
Well, no, you just see him in a kind of a new light in that kind of tweedy professorial kind of way.
Because
you're used to seeing him with the fedora and the whip and everything. Like,
uh-huh.
But that scene. I wouldn't go as far.
I've incorporated both.
I understand. I wouldn't go as far as to paint love you on my eyelids, because that is just, that's not the power move. That's not the play there. There's no coming back from that.
You're sort of right in the corner with that.
Exactly.
It's a little needy.
You got to be more circumspect. You got to do as a very handsome, shy, skinny boy does in that same scene. You got to leave an apple on the teacher's desk. Which, if you remember the scene, is not picked up by Indiana Jones, but is picked up by Denholm Elliott, which that's a whole chapter of the celluloid closet going on right there.
Oh, my goodness.
But while we're on the tweet tip, I got to represent my people. Doctor Who, played by Matt Smith, the 11th Doctor. He's bringing the tweed. He's bringing the bow tie. This show, if you think about it, over the course of its, you know, started out in 1963, went till 1989, took a 16-year break, and then came back in 2005. This show is really about the changing, shifting dynamic between teacher and student, because Doctor Who always travels with a companion, and in years past, that was explained from a purely plot perspective. We need an audience surrogate, somebody to kind of ask questions. Now, as the show's come back, they are really putting a characterization spin on that, where he needs a companion because otherwise he's the guy with all the answers. You know, he's got all the answers in the back of the book. He knows them all. And he needs somebody to humanize him, to bring him down to earth. Otherwise, he can kind of get removed and act sort of pitiless and merciless and cruel. But over the course of this show's run, there have been all kinds of student-teacher dynamics. There's been the really sort of grumpy, grandfatherly type. There's been the cool, hip teacher,
mm-hmm,
you know, with the ruffles and the pinky rings.
Uh-huh.
There's been the kind of goony teacher who you kind of look forward to having him in class because, uh-huh, he's going to go take some place. And recently, they've addressed the sort of sexual subtext, which is always there, but not acted upon because British, and it just creates this tension. So it's a really, if you think about it, there is a master's thesis, I think, in the kind of shifting relationships of the different doctors and the different kinds of student-teacher dynamics there are.
I am really glad that you went there, because I wanted to do something very much like that with a string of characters from Shakespeare's plays.
Good.
So I went and looked at Prospero in The Tempest, mm-hmm. and Viola in The Merchant of Venice, and I wanted to argue that they can be construed as having aspects of the pedagogue. Prospero is defined in many ways.
Stephen and I are just making books. Faces at each other.
Yeah,
I just leaned into the microphone and went.
By the way, I'm going to be calling my new sweater store mm-hmm.
Aspects of the Pedagogue. Fine. I should have known when I wrote that note.
Yeah. You should have known.
Okay,
you
fine.
Really should have known.
Fine. Anyway. Prospero is kind of defined by his books in uh-huh. many ways. They are the source of his power. But at the end of the play, instead of exacting his revenge, as he had intended to do, to kill all the people who marooned him on this island, he teaches his enemies a lesson about right dealing and forgives them. And then he surrenders his magic in much the same way that a teacher at the end of a course surrenders authority over the student and becomes the student's equal. Uh-huh. And I sort of like that. Now, Viola in The Merchant of Venice, problematic as she and the play both are, she does get one of the great bits of Shakespearean rhetoric. And I'm going to argue that rhetoric deployed toward a morally sound end is a kind of teaching. So the quality of mercy speech, even though it is a problematic speech, it's a little condescending, is a kind of moral instruction.
He leans back from the mic.
or drops the mic,
yeah,
as
it's
it
like,
were.
He wouldn't drop it. It's too expensive.
No, it's far too expensive. It's true. You can't think about Hamlet without thinking of teaching. He is a student at university, for one thing, but he also delivers an instructional
speech. Well, I
speech.
Can.
I've gone all this time.
Well, come on. He delivers an instructional speech to the players about how to be emotionally authentic on stage when they stage the Mousetrap.
Uh-huh.
And then there's Polonius.
Of course.
That's what I was about to say.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's just advice.
and he's actually giving it to his son, so that's more paternal than anything else.
Yes, but
we're talk about pop culture dads.
Here's the thing. Polonius is a buffoon character, and the speech is intended to make him out to be kind of shallow and pedantic and trite. But over the centuries, that speech has become loaded up with layers of meaning, and it now sort of reads as a great literary example of moral instruction.
We'll take it.
I'm going to assume that was great.
Kind of taking this aspect of the pedagogue very seriously.
Because Trey is sort of at the head of the class right now, yeah. And Linda and Glenn and I are kind of...
So, Stephen, I want you to start talking about what? Professor Poopy Pants? Who you got?
Gabe Kaplan.
I am gonna bet that Stephen is going to go directly to Edna Crabapple.
Yes.
Well, okay.
Well, since Glenn took Giles... For one thing.
And Trey took Prospero.
Trey did take Prospero.
I haven't even mentioned Septimus Hodge in Arcadia.
No, that's
dude,
a good one.
You already stole my thunder on it, Edna Krabappel. I think the professor, whatever form the professor takes in a lot of popular culture, really the professor is the exposition king or queen.
Mm-hmm.
The professor is there in large part to sort of serve as an authority figure who can spit out and even write down gobs of exposition in context to keep the viewer plugged in. I saw a really interesting interview with Joss Whedon talking about Giles on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and he was sort of saying how important it was to him to have a character who is there to say things like, "The vampires are coming and only the Book of Thoth can stop them." And I think that sort of character very often takes kind of a professorly quality. Now, a professor-type character who does not do that is Edna Krabappel, and I want to point out that as little as I know about Shakespeare, and I actually knew last week when you mentioned Shakespeare that you were talking about Mercutio, so I know a little something mm-hmm. about Shakespeare, but I am to Shakespeare as Trey is to The Simpsons, since Trey pronounced it Edna Crabapple.
Right. Yeah, well, I didn't say I'd ever seen it. We are on record with the show as I've never seen an episode of that show, except for the Streetcar Named March, or whatever it is.
It it's interesting. I was going back and forth, you know, figuring somebody might take my Giles Glenn Weldon, that, you know, in terms of who, you know, who is a great teacher example on The Simpsons. And I feel like Miss Hoover gets a little bit of short shrift as a delightful practitioner of incredibly dry, uninterested, indifferent teaching.
She gave the world a perfectly cromulent word.
So. It is a perfectly cromulent word. That's correct. But I immediately when Edna Krabappel came to mind, I thought of the line, "Oh, don't worry, children. Most of you will never fall in love, but will marry out of fear of dying alone."
She has so much to teach us.
She does.
Let's take Edna Krabappel and put her at one end of a spectrum of teacher tropes in pop culture. She's the burnout, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's Ben Stein in Ferris Bueller.
Ferris Bueller, yeah.
Sure.
And at the other
end, are you coming up with a taxonomy of teachers?
Yes. I'm going to establish the goalposts, the end posts, and you guys can fill in the middle. The other end, of course, is the white knight, and they are almost always white knights who ride into an inner city school and help the underperforming, underprivileged children at risk.
Or if we're going to talk about teachers on The Simpsons, the greatest teacher on The Simpsons is the Dustin Hoffman substitute teacher who comes in and...
Mr. Bergstrom.
You may call me Mr. Nerdstrom or Mr. Boogerstrom. Oh, my God. There is a... That was actually... I'm really glad that one came up. That's from a fairly early episode. Probably, was it season two?
Something like that.
Where Miss Hoover thinks she has Lyme disease. And so they bring in a substitute teacher played by Dustin Hoffman, Mr. Bergstrom, who is the perfect substitute teacher. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the first, if not the first episode of The Simpsons that actually really made me choke up.
Yeah.
Like on several occasions where that show has this gigantic heart to it, and there's this there are several amazing kind of tear-jerking moments in that particular episode, but it's a wonderful profile sort of what makes a great teacher and what makes a great teacher for kids like Lisa.
Agreed. So on the White Knight tip, you've got Dangerous Minds.
Yep.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
As an ex-Marine.
Yeah. Summer School, Mark Harmon.
I'm not sure he's exactly White Knight. There's a little inappropriate line blurring there, right?
Stand and Deliver.
Right? Yes.
Blackboard Jungle.
Blackboard Jungle, of course.
Although Stand and Deliver is an actual Latino teacher.
Yes.
That is true.
It is a little different.
And what's the one with Morgan Freeman as the principal?
Lean on Me.
Lean on Me.
Yep.
Lean on Me.
And we have to discuss...
So an exception to the White Knight rule.
Sure.
Right. Oh, of course.
Discuss Dead Poets Society, or let's not.
Do we have to?
I was going to say...
So it had to come up.
I hate that movie.
It is a... that is, again, sort of the White Knight end of things. And one of the things that I discovered as I got into thinking about this myself was that I tend to be somewhat dissatisfied with portrayals of teachers because I grew up around teachers. My parents were both teachers. And I have always found that there was a weird dichotomy of, like, on the one hand, you had sort of these incredibly noble teachers who often were not actually trying to teach you the subject as much as they were trying to teach you life, like how to live. And that would be kind of your Dead Poets Society teacher. Many of your White Knight teachers are like that.
Mr. Bergstrom.
And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have your unlikable, cold, mean teachers and professors who are, you know, obsessed with order and everybody rebels against them and they're just trying to keep you down and stuff like that. And I think there's often perhaps not enough appreciation for teachers who see their primary function as to teach you the material and understand that if they support you and encourage your intellectual curiosity, that can come out of the material. It doesn't have to come out of sitting down and being like, let's talk about sucking the marrow out of life and so forth. So when Dead Poets Society first came out, I actually really liked it. Now I was like 19 or however old I was. Mm-hmm. And when it came out, I really liked it. But I think it's one of those things that doesn't age well at all. And by the time you get older, you're more struck by something that I unfortunately do not remember who it was. But some teacher that I had said to me, a really good teacher has students, not disciples.
Right.
and I think that's
a great line.
And that has really stuck with me. And I think when you go back and watch that movie now, what you see is the desire to create a cult of personality around yourself, which is a very dangerous thing for teachers, I think, when that Robin Williams character kind of wants to have that experience. And so I think what I have started to gravitate toward more as I get older is simpler things. Like when you talk about Stand and Deliver, on the one hand, yes, you know, Stand and Deliver is a lot about believe in yourself and all that stuff. But primarily, he's teaching calculus.
Right.
Primarily, that's his primary goal, is to teach calculus. And I think that's one of the strengths of that film, in retrospect, is that it is primarily about the teaching of the material. Now, obviously, that can get a little bit mushier when you're talking about people who teach something other than math, because it's a little bit easier with math to differentiate. The other one I wanted to mention was The Paper Chase.
Sure.
Which, of course, you know, law professors are not actually, in my experience, quite that terrifying. But that sort of intimidating method of teaching does exist even outside of Harvard and places like that. So The Paper Chase is one. The other thing is, as with many things, I will raise a documentary that I would suggest that everybody keep an eye out for, because it is going to be released sometime this fall. I don't remember the exact date. And I talked about it on the blog because I saw it at South by Southwest. It also played at Silver Ducks. It's called Brooklyn Castle, and it's about the chess team at a public school in New York. And there are a couple of teachers in that movie who are really, really fun to watch. A chess teacher, a principal. If you really want to see how really good teachers operate, watch real teachers, not movie teachers, because I don't actually think Hollywood is especially good at presenting teachers and professors. So,
yeah, my favorite professors and teachers were never trying to teach me about life. Like, if you don't bore me, I have so much appreciation.
Yeah.
And I say this in the present tense as if I've taken a class in the last 20 plus years.
Yeah.
But those were always the teachers I loved, were just the ones who made the material interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Now, Trey, you saw Alan Bennett's The History Boys, right?
I did.
Okay. So that's about these boys in a British public school, which is our equivalent of a private school, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
Who are in this history class, and there's two rival teachers, one who is teaching them facts, and the other is trying to teach them how to ace the test, how to adopt these slick, clever tropes where you ask a very sort of unconventional question so that it seems as if you're thinking when actually you're just sort of following some kind of convention. A really interesting, not perfect, but a really interesting play that I really liked. I'm going to say the 1953 film, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. Starring Hans Conried as the evil piano teacher, redundant, Dr. Terwilliger, which I think they got
Bob Terwilliger.
Bob Terwilliger from. Do you ever see To Sir With Love?
I don't think I have seen it.
I don't think I've seen it either.
I know of it.
It's one of those things that's in everybody's to-watch list.
Yeah.
Years ago, the Philadelphia UHF stations used to play Our Miss Brooks, starring Eve Arden. That is a thing that just, you could eat up an entire afternoon. That just goes down really easily. A series of children's books, the Miss Nelson series, Miss Nelson is Missing. You guys remember these books?
No.
No.
Okay. What about The Magic School Bus? You know, the cartoon in the book series, The Magic School Bus. I was too old for it.
I was going to say I was too old for it, too.
But it gave Lily Tomlin a steady paycheck, so right, right there.
So hooray for that.
Hooray for that. And then, yeah, that's the only one I had besides Dead Poets Society, which
Since Glenn touched on a play, I only briefly mentioned Arcadia earlier.
Yeah.
But that is a play. If you ever get a chance to see it, please do, because, first of all, it's a glorious play. But the dynamic between Thomasina Coverley, who is the child prodigy in the 18th century, and Septimus, her tutor, is one of the more beautiful things I've ever seen on a stage.
It's really good. It's a tour de force play. It's Stoppard's best, and that is saying something.
That is saying a lot.
Well, I hope that all of you will tell us in one of our various social media spaces about your favorite teachers and professors. I realize when I say things like social media spaces, it sounds like I'm a gigantic nerd, but I just don't want to rattle off our Facebook page address, but I will. It's facebook.com/PCHH, or you can come to the blog and let us know, teachers, professors, what means something to you, what you find to be compelling, and are we all wrong after all these years about Dead Poets Society? Spoiler alert, no. So that brings us to our final segment, which is what's making us happy this week. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. You know, I've been working on this book that I've been working on for a long time, that I've been yammering on about for a year.
Don't say.
Yeah, but I never printed it out. It exists purely on my computer. It could be securely in the cloud. But then this last week, my publisher sent me a mock-up of the cover of the book, which is a thing that makes it real in a way that it has not been heretofore, and it looks great, so that made me happy.
It happens to be a great cover.
It looks
great. I don't like a lot of covers, but I like that one.
But the main thing, though, is that yesterday's New York Times Book Review had an interview with Emma Thompson. Now, I don't have celebrity crushes. Again, I value the product, not the person. But I have been following Emma Thompson ever since she did a BBC sketch comedy show called Thompson, only 8 episodes, back in 1988, before she and Branagh were kind of hooking up, I think, about the time they were. That was brilliant. So the New York Times Book Review asks her, what book should the president read? Her answer, and I'm quoting, the president, any president, could usefully acquaint himself or herself with Walt Kelly's pogo.
Okay.
Good Lord.
All right, lady.
Oh, man. And then when asked if she'd ever written a fan letter to an author, she mentioned that when she was 8 years old, she wrote to René Goscinny, the guy behind Asterix de Gaulle, and he wrote back. So aww. She, like, if...
How? She's got to be related to my family.
Good Lord. Jeez, I had the vapors. So that would make me very happy.
Oh, that's wonderful. Huh? I like that choice very much.
She's a class act.
Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
The first season of the sci-fi series Eureka, which I have been catching up on via Hulu Plus, has been a pleasant diversion over the last few days, and that is always a happy-making experience. Mm-hmm.
My mother loves that show and has tried to get me to watch it.
It's kind of agreeably geeky. And
that's
just,
my mother.
And just formulaic enough that you don't really need to pay close attention.
Uh-huh. That's good for,
it's kind of fun.
Good for passing time.
Exactly. Nicer still to note that there are four more seasons for me to amuse myself with, so uh-huh. There's that. But what's really, truly, honestly making me happy this week, the stage director, Michael Kahn, who runs the Shakespeare Theater here in D.C., and for many years chaired the drama program at the Juilliard School in New York, where he taught everyone from Robin Williams to William Hurt to Meryl Streep to Patti LuPone to Michael Urey to Laura Linney. Well, he was inducted into the Theater Hall of Fame this week. And because I know him a little bit and I count him as a little bit of a friend, that is making me happy. The year's other inductees are people like Betty Buckley and Sam Waterston and the playwright Paula Vogel and Andre Bishop, who runs Lincoln Center Theater. So Michael is in good company, and many congratulations to him.
Wonderful.
Delightful.
Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I've talked a little bit in recent months about how much music I've been listening to this year is sort of, for me, sort of uncharacteristically happy. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've talked about Japandroids, Best Coast, stuff that's hugely uplifting. And then I discovered that a singer named Jason Molina is putting out a new record this week. Now, Jason Molina makes music that is sadder than the saddest thing you can possibly conjure.
I was just going to say, am I thinking of the wrong guy?
No, yeah, you know, you probably know, because I do these little year-end compilation CDs, he has a song called Get Out, Get Out, Get Out that is the most crushingly beautiful and sad thing ever. And he's been sort of underground for the last few years, dealing with some medical issues, and has really been off the grid and off the map. And this recording that's coming out this week, unfortunately, is not a new recording. I did get word that he is quote-unquote on the mend, which I was delighted to hear. But it's a record called Autumn Bird Songs. It's eight songs, and it's a companion piece to a book of art by an artist named Will Schaff. Not to be confused with Will Schaff of Vacaville River, whose albums have art by Will Schaff, which is very confusing.
Oh, God.
But the Will Schaff book is called From Black Sheep Boys to Bill Collectors, and it's a collection of beautiful art, and it comes with this CD by Jason Molina. And I'm going to throw in a little clip of a song here by Jason Molina called The Harvest Law.
Devil on your shadow's wings, the whole world you've been balancing, and as our lot does fall, there's the law, there's the law.
So that's The Harvest Law by Jason Molina. It's from a little mini album, eight songs, called Autumn Bird Songs. It's beautiful. If you haven't dug into the work of Jason Molina, he's recorded under the name Songs Ohio. He's recorded with a band called Magnolia Electric Company. A lot of his stuff is just really devastatingly beautiful. Check him out.
Wonderful. Thank you, Stephen. So making me happy this week, let's see. Well, as we tape this, tonight is the return of Dancing with the Stars. Specifically, it is the return of Dancing with the Stars All Stars. And I am not going to lie to you. If you tell me that I get a chance to see Emmett Smith dance again, that is awesome because I loved watching Emmett Smith dance.
Mm-hmm. Who's Emmett Smith?
Emmett Smith was a football player.
Okay.
I once got a text from you, Linda, years ago, just out of the blue. I pick up my phone, I look at it, there's a text message that says, Emmett Smith, ? All caps, can dance.
I'm sure I did say that. There's also Apollo Anton Ono, the speed skater,
sure,
who is adorable and great fun. Drew Lachey, former boy band member, adorable and great fun. And a bunch of women also.
Also the women.
I just realized I was naming dudes. But
sorry, until they bring back Kate Gosselin, not watching.
Yeah, but they do have a lot of really fun people, and I'm actually kind of excited about it. I'm not going to lie. The other thing I wanted to mention this week is I mentioned a couple weeks ago that I was reading a bunch of Pauline Kael. I have also been reading a book by Jay Hoberman, who used to work for The Village Voice, which is called Film After Film. And it's a book about American film after 2001, after September 11th, and sort of what the turning points were. And I think if you read this book, you find that certain things you may feel are not as closely related to, are not as closely circumscribed by their relationship to September 11th as he sort of thinks they are. There are a lot of conclusions being drawn, not all of which I necessarily agree with, but it's a very interesting book. It's full of some of the stuff he wrote for The Village Voice, some stuff he wrote elsewhere, and some new stuff. And I'm enjoying it a lot, and it's just a big smarty pants book about movies, and I was very pleased to find it, and it is available as an ebook. It's a I'm sure available as a regular book, if that's, you know, your thing. Good book and the return of my dancing show are the two things making me happy this week. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.